So without further ado, I would like to introduce our second expert speaker, representing the topic area of land resources. And this will be Forrest Smith. He is Dan L. Duncan, Endowed Director of South Texas Natives and Texas Native Seeds Projects, and Cesar Klebarg, Wildlife Research of the Cesar Klebarg Wildlife Research Institute, Texas A&M University, Kingsville. So are you okay to come on up to the podium? Okay, let's give him a welcome. Thank you.
Thank you all for allowing me to be here and sharing your hill country allergies. I've got a nice case. I'm a hill country native, grew up near Goldthwaite, north of here. So I've developed allergies and I escaped them in South Texas. And then when I come back, I get a fresh case. That last presentation was fascinating to see the amount of information on a topic. I have the reverse of that. I have a topic that we don't have a lot of information on. And those of you that may be on this committee who have looked for information are aware of that. I'm going to present some of what we do know about the effects of shale oil and gas development on land resources. Land resources to me, and I think to many of you, it's hard to distinctly define that. What is the land resource? And so I looked at this from the perspective of land in the context that some of us that work with wildlife and work with habitat and work with landscape ecology would approach this. The other obvious point I want to make right up front is that my subjects that I'm going to talk about are undeniably interrelated with other subject matters here. I'm glad that water follows because it's hard to separate soil issues from water issues and even vegetation issues from water issues. I think when we talk about transportation, it's almost impossible to break apart transportation needs and how those affect land fragmentation and land use. Another key point in everything I'm going to talk about, and obviously I think that most anyone here will talk about, it's that these impacts are spatial and temporal. At one well per 1,000 acres, a lot of the impacts I may talk about are relatively benign. At greater intensity, greater development, mass scale production, these impacts become very acute and very, very problematic. From a temporal standpoint, a lot of the end effects of a disturbance like oil and gas production or pipeline construction or road construction take time to manifest in a habitat or in a wildlife species or in a watershed. So some of the things that were done historically in Texas in the oil and gas industry are really just now coming to the surface and impacting things like downstream water quality or levels of contaminants in water systems or rivers. So there's a lot we don't know in this topic. And I think there's a whole lot that we don't know from historic development and exploration. And I think we're too young in shale oil and gas development to know yet if some of what I'm going to talk about today is accurate going forward. But overall, when we get into topic areas of land impacts, despite a century of oil and gas production, we have literally just 10 or 15 studies on things like impacts of pad sites on soils, impacts of development on vegetation resources, and we've studied virtually only two or three wildlife species, specifically in the context of shale oil and gas development. That case study is extremely varied, having taken place over many different disciplines, many different time periods, frankly, most available research on these impacts deals with traditional oil and gas production. So it can and may differ pretty greatly from the same impacts we may see in shale oil and gas development. But we approached this and broke this into three kind of major areas of concern when you deal with land issues. Soils are the basis of land, obviously. The amalgamation of features on the landscape and development on the landscape has very big effects and very pronounced effects on things like landscape function, landscape fragmentation, and habitat loss for could be wildlife, could be ranching, could be farming, both human and wildlife habitat. Also, a lot of these effects probably are most clearly addressed and most clearly manifested in vegetation. So when we study the plant community, whether that be the native plant community or the introduced or invasive plant community, and then what do we do about it? I think that's the question this committee probably where it wants to go in the end is what do we do to mitigate some of this? And I'm going to make the case that in the absence of development, or rather unless we don't develop, we have one solution, and that's that we get better at restoring a lot of these disturbances. But there are soil issues associated with oil and gas production. No secret, no fact there that you can deny. There's even amongst the classification of land in the state of Texas, the USDA has a succinct site of land that they call an oil-filled wasteland range site. That's from a past time and a past legacy, but I hope it illustrates that obviously you can have things like spills, soil contamination that drastically change the land. Erosion issues with soils and their effects on watersheds and communities is also a very, very important part of this. There's a couple case studies, and they're very small case studies. And so instead of basing some of these conclusions and observations off of hundreds of sites and hundreds of measurements, like Peter might have had, you know, we've got inferences in this realm based off of single graduate thesis done on three pad sites or two pad sites. And they obviously documented effects, and they found things that I think we should look at going forward. But studying three pad sites or two pad sites, or in this next study, studying just one county as part of a development, it's probably not broad enough for me or anyone else to stand up here and say, okay, pad site building because of shale oil and gas development has this major effect on soil erosion. The kind of dots on the map that we do have, as limited as they are, is that they show there is an impact of disturbing the soil surface and disturbing the landscape with oil and gas construction. And it will affect soil erosion. One of the glaring deficiencies, I think, in the available information is that there's very few studies that deal with pipelines. And Texas has an enormous pipeline infrastructure, enormous pipeline footprint. And those pipelines effect on soil erosion into watersheds is really unknown. So this is an area where we certainly need to know more. When we deal with soil contamination, again, with all the history of production we have, we've studied it very infrequently. Drilling that happens on a federal land like on Padre Island has been studied intensively, and they found contamination. Those were historic sites. Special environment, so those impacts may not be the same everywhere. On other sites in South Texas, soil salinity tends to be a major issue. But again, in historic production where saltwater dumping or spillage may have happened, whereas today on clean sites and cleaner technology, we may not have that same problem. But I don't think anyone today is looking at pad sites and development in current shale plays and seeing if we're building soil contamination issues. Probably should, probably need to. West Texas, obviously, you can see the past scars of oil and gas development and of pad sites. So I think it's clear that soil contamination can and has and probably does occur, but the diversity of soils we have, the diversity of operators we have, again, it's real hard to draw a broad conclusion and say this is this issue and this is a measurement of it. One topic that's being researched with support from HARC and Texas General Land Office is the issue of mixed soils on pipeline right-of-ways. Pipeline right-of-ways, by the nature of their construction, end up bringing soils from very deep in the profile to the top, and those sites can become extremely difficult for vegetation to grow on. There's also some concern, I think, amongst landowners of fracking issues, and anybody that's ever spent time on a shale oil and gas pad site, you will see things like sands used in the process spilled to the side or proppants spilled to the side. And what effects might those have on soils? I think this is probably one of the biggest issues we need to address, and one that we probably have the most amount of information on just because it's somewhat easier to study and to document. But that's the topic of fragmentation and habitat loss. This affects not only land resources and wildlife, but it affects those other land uses that are important in Texas. The Eagle Ford 23,000 pads that were drilled up to 2014 had a footprint of 84,000 acres. That's maybe 1/20th of the development of the Eagle Ford. So do the math, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. We also have a massive influx of roads and pipeline infrastructure that's not documented in that figure. So just from a footprint standpoint, this is important to land use. We're taking acres off the table for other land uses and other productivities, which has an economic impact as well as a habitat one. I think something that many people in the public don't really understand is that something like an oil pad has that direct impact that may be 3 acre size, but the actual functional footprint is usually far larger than that from an ecological sense. Can we generalize the effects of that landscape change? I don't think the data that we have says we can. I mean, we've studied certain wildlife species, endangered species, lesser prairie chicken, lizards, where we know very good information about how their ecology is affected. We've studied other economically important species like bobwhite quail, scaled quail. Bobwhite quail seem almost unaffected by Eagle Ford development. Scaled quail leave the area or restricted in their movements by something as simple as a new right-of-way that breaks contiguous habitat. But overall, I think at the broad level, development of land for oil and gas uses represents some form of raw habitat loss, and it does have some corresponding effect on wildlife, some maybe positively, some negatively. But overall, it's very poorly studied in Texas. I think that's the key point. There's two footprints, and again, I think the footprint of pipelines and the importance of those broad disturbance corridors, particularly with new ones going to have to be built if Texas ever becomes an LNG player, and their effects on habitats, let's say in deep South Texas, that are relatively unfragmented and undisturbed, it's a great opportunity for study and something we need to learn more about. Fragmentation, again, it's been measured here and there. There's case studies. There's study of the Eagle Ford early on in LaSalle County that came up with big numbers that are kind of eye-catching. You know, you increase habitat fragmentation by 62%. That's a lot. That means a lot for wildlife and the ecology of that area. Soil erosion increases are very possible with that amount of fragmentation. Barnett Shell, similar observations. I think, again, we have some data. It's pretty convincing. Private ranchers like Joseph know this. They see this. I think one of the things that all of us can do in this realm when we think about habitat change, loss, and fragmentation is to look at satellite imagery and some good landscape ecology studies that quantify the change in habitat arrangement, in habitat availability, and land impacts would be very, very important to the state. And then just look, and if you've been in these intense development areas, or if you look at imagery that's available to anyone, you see that change. You see that 8 to 10% of the landscape being completely altered from a relatively unfragmented but agricultural landscape to a landscape that's very much punctuated by development. Same thing is possible in the western parts of the Eagle Ford and certainly in the Permian Basin also. I think, again, this becomes a matter of intensity and scale. If we develop large areas of the state to this level of disturbance, we're going to see more and more of these impacts, and they're going to be more and more important. But if the spatial scale of development is restricted, and we do things like common pad site drilling, this is probably less of an issue. The final thing I'm going to touch on is vegetation, and that's the part of this that I'm very familiar with and that I work real closely with. My program is aimed at native plant conservation and dealing with invasive species issues and doing habitat restoration. Again, there's very little information out there. When we think about the question on the street of what does developing the Eagle Ford Shale mean to vegetation? We've not studied that, really. What has it done to vegetation in the Permian Basin and in West Texas? Haven't studied it. We've studied it in a few unique places like Padre Island and maybe as part of small case studies on private ranches. But even though we've built hundreds of thousands of miles of pipelines, hundreds of thousands of well pads, tens of thousands of disposal wells, on and on and on, and with all the great vegetation researchers we have at state universities, we haven't asked that question and studied it. We haven't looked at long-term effects on vegetation and plant communities in this state. And if you go elsewhere, you'll find that information. You can't touch some of these federal lands in the West without extensive documentation of vegetation effects and also effects on things like wildlife that correspond from vegetation. Some recent stuff that's been done has identified, I think, some concerns as to why we need to study vegetation impacts. When we look at historic pad sites, there's a propensity for invasive species to thoroughly establish there and then spread from those sites into surrounding areas. Again, the more darts we throw in the map, the more of a problem that becomes. At small scales of development, you don't have that many starts of invasive plants into habitats, but at thousands and thousands of sites, at close proximities together, there becomes very little area in between that's not truly impacted. What little information we have available would lead one to think this is something to look into more closely. And when we look at land issues, and when you poll anyone in the conservation community in Texas, you'll find that things like invasive species issues are at the top of their list for things we need to worry about on our landscape. There's an interplay with shale oil and gas development, but it's very poorly understood. But I think if we look at the context of disturbance is obviously created by oil and gas development. Disturbance and many times favors invasive plant species. We need to find out what's in between there and what it means. A lot of these plants of great concern in the areas that are going to be or already are subject to shale oil and gas development are grasses that were brought here from Africa for the livestock industry and for soil erosion concerns, but increasingly are plants that people don't desire for their land use today. Things like buffle grass, Lehman love grass. I'm going to close and just throw some restoration ideas out there, and I think this is one area that there is a little more information available. And I think the take-home from that information is that there can be a lot of success in restoration. There can be activities done by both operators, landowners, agencies that can kind of take a lot of these concerns off the table. That is a great piece of habitat for wildlife, a great piece of land for ranching, a functioning landscape that's not going to have negative consequences for an adjacent watershed. But that's a pad site, and it was a pad site for 50 years before it was restored. But hopefully that, just in a photographic sense, says that aerial view looking down at bare ground and erosion concerns could instead be this and be a positive for land issues. The same thing is possible with pipeline right-of-ways. Instead of being looked at as a point of fragmentation and a point of habitat loss or land loss for ranching, they can instead be a very productive and very beneficial part of the landscape. So I guess to wrap it all together and try to leave time for a question or two, you know, when you ask to do a scientific review of the available information on land impacts, it would be a short science paper because there's not a lot there. Maybe there's more than I found, but I don't think there is. I think we've kind of overlooked this topic, number one, because of economic factors. Number two, because of most of this development historically occurring on private lands. And from an economic sense, oil and gas benefits to private landowners so far outweighed their interest in the effect of that development on vegetation that it was simply overlooked. But as we scale this out and development occurs in new areas, and as we're in a different era socially of caring about our environment, I think it's time we go back and we study that past disturbance. We determine if there's an effect that's going to come in the next 50 years if we drill 200,000 more wells in Texas. And what is that effect, and what can we do to begin to remediate some of it now? I think we have a lot of the tools to deal with what I perceive are the issues. We can do restoration. More and more operators and landowners are requiring it. And honestly, I think that's the direction we should all be looking at to move forward in this. You know, not only documenting that there's issues, and again, I think some of these issues are no-brainers, but let's tell the public, let's tell the industry, let's tell everyone we can do something about this topic. I think we need to study all of this at the play level, at the broader level. We don't need small case studies to look at three pad sites. We need to do long-term studies on land effects in the Eagle Ford Shale, in the Barnett Shale, in the Permian. We need to measure some of these things. Let's see if there's this cumulative environmental impact that's been suggested. Certainly, some people on other sides of this than maybe some of us in the room think that there's a horrendous environmental impact of shale, oil, and gas development. But I think us as a science-guided community, we should measure it and see. We should give people the hard numbers to know if there are problems on the horizon. Vegetation studies, you know, even a single study over one play would be very informative to, again, guiding how we need to do restoration and guiding how we develop these areas. I've put together a bibliography of the sources I looked at in this presentation, and I think some of those sources will be good in your development of a draft. I'm certainly glad to take any questions and certainly glad to be here to present to you. Thank you.
Well, we are right up against coffee time. So I tell you what we're going to do. We'll go to about 10:05. And we're not going to readjust coffee time, so this is eating into coffee. But I think we got a couple of questions at least over here, and I wouldn't want to avoid those. So we'll start with Melinda.
Thank you, Forrest. That was a very interesting presentation. We appreciate it very much on the Land Committee. You mentioned in everything you said about the dearth of data, the lack of studies is consistent with what we've found so far as well. You did mention pipeline studies. I think you said this, that we might be able to find pipeline studies elsewhere. Are there some other than on just mm-hmm. individual projects on federal lands?
I think in the Haynesville Shale area, that's been a contentious issue, and they've studied some of the effects of pipeline infrastructure. Nebraska has been acutely involved in that and is even at the state level passed laws that dictate how pipelines are handled when it comes to restoration. They have the marquee law for restoring native plants on a pipeline right of way, and it came from the Keystone pipeline issues. Things like that I think should be looked at and discussed. But yes, there is information elsewhere, but When you cross state boundaries and ecosystem boundaries, it gets hard to compare that and generalize. For example, there's a study in the Northeast that linked pipeline corridors to increased predation of deer by coyotes. I mean, these clear steps. But that was a forested environment that had no openings in it. And when you created openings for coyotes to travel, they then ate deer. Well, that's not real relevant. You know, in South Texas, we've got roads and senderos, and we fragment the landscape just ranching it and enjoying it. So we've got to be careful there. But When it comes to invasive species on pipeline right-of-ways, there's some good information out there. There's also a lot of information on roads. And I didn't deal with roads a lot, but when we deal with these large expanses of private land, we're having to build a lot of new, you know, caliche roads on them. And those roads are going to be impactful.
Real quickly, I really enjoyed that discussion coming from a ranching background myself. But one thing I might offer as an idea is we do have a neighbor in the Permian Basin in New Mexico with lots of BLM properties, federal lands, that might be an easier match for looking at the studies. Another thing that we have in Texas is UT lands, which has large contiguous holdings in West Texas that might make excellent places to study these things.
That's a great point. I think it could be a hot topic because I think some of the development of the UT lands, you know, and this has been brought up recently in the media by some environmental organizations, but it is certainly a good place to study this. I think if we would look at it from the standpoint of let's study it, learn about it, and not just do it to beat somebody in the past up, it could be very productive. Because the issue that you get into in a private land state when you start in studying environmental issues is, you know, there's people that don't want to be involved in that, and having a public entity is the place to be a case study for some of this. Great idea. BLM in New Mexico is also a good resource, and is where some of the dune sagebrush lizard information and knowledge certainly comes from. Because again, you had an opportunity for the science community to assess it and deal with it. Great points. Joseph?
I won't get into the coffee earnings. You and I have discussed these matters quite a bit, but you mentioned, if I'll paraphrase, we could do a better job than we're doing. We have some successes in restoration and reclamation. But how do we get it done? Who pays for it? You know, you mentioned some landowners have the resources, but a lot of these landowners don't own their minerals. And there's no requirement to do any of this. So the patchwork and fragmentation I see more as more than just the fragmentation created there. There's a fragmentation of remediation, reclamation. And as one of your colleagues said, it's easier to restore it if you don't tear it up in the first place.
Absolutely.
So planning, some required planning before you start the impact.
And I agree with that. And I think in the current legal and regulatory context we have, that becomes a landowner education issue. Well, you've got to inform private land stewards how to make sure that's addressed. At a broader public policy level, see that pipeline reclamation law in Nebraska probably says very little different than a lot of landowner surface use agreements for pipelines, but it has the weight of a state behind it. And it's not restrictive. It doesn't tie people's hands. It just simply puts the negotiation table in the equation and makes it part of it. I think as development reaches some point, citizens in Texas are going to break over and say, yeah, you know what, we need to be stewards of this at a legal level. Because right now, it's kind of the Wild West.
Okay, even there, we went a little farther. Let's give one more big hand to our speaker. And much appreciated if you can go and have a little coffee, talk with the speakers as you like, and let's be back at 10:20.